The following talk, Beyond Economic Growth, was featured at a forum on ecological economics sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin on April 14, 2007. The speaker, Joshua Farley, is an ecological economist at the University of Vermont. He argues that the obsession of most economists with economic growth is misguided. A sustainable economy, not ever-increasing consumption, is the key to a better quality of life for us all. Farley is Assistant Professor of Community Development and Applied Economics at the University of Vermont and Fellow at the Gund Institute of Ecological Economics. Professor Joshua Farley.
What I want to talk about today is beyond economic growth. That we live in a society right now where, as you know, Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid. He means we need more and more economic growth. So we live in a society where the driving force behind all our activities can be economic growth. Everybody's striving for raises. Everybody's striving to get better jobs. Everybody's striving to consume more, have bigger houses, bigger cars. This is the society we live in, and I want to challenge that view that economic growth is, first of all, I would challenge the view that it's possible to have continuous economic growth. And second, I would challenge the view that it's desirable. So the outline of my presentation, I want to first talk about what are the perceived benefits of economic growth. Why is it that people think we need more economic growth? Second, I want to talk about the physical constraints on economic growth. Bring some of the laws of physics and the laws of ecology into the economic question, which are too often left out. Then I want to talk about whether or not economic growth is desirable, whether or not it's a fundamental facet of human nature to desire ever more consumption, whether or not it improves our well-being in any way, at least in the wealthy countries. I strongly argue that in the very poor nations, economic growth is necessary. Then I want to look at some of the alternatives. What can we do? What choices do we have besides continued growth? And then look at, you know, what's going to guide us? What's going to get us to where we want to be? So to begin with, I'm going to start out with what I think are three fairly useful definitions. First of all, when I'm talking about economic growth, I am talking about physical increase in the size of the economy. So there's this idea of throughput. Economists sometimes talk about inputs into the economy. Ecological economists talk about throughputs. They say that there's raw materials coming from nature that are transformed into things that provide us with economic benefits and then are returned to the ecosystem as waste. So we look at this idea of throughput. And I'll talk more about that as I go. And also this idea about, so economic growth I'm defining as an increase in throughput. It's an increasing rate of extraction of raw materials from the ecosystem and the spewing back of waste. And I also want to talk about the idea of scale, which is the physical size of the economy relative to the ecosystem that sustains and contains it. And this idea that the ecosystem sustains and contains the economy is, among the economists, unique to ecological economics. Other branches of economics look at the ecosystem as a subsystem of the economic system. Ecological economists look at the economic system as a subsystem of the ecosystem. So to begin with, why is it that our society is so adamant that economic growth is essential? Capitalism depends on growth. It's like riding a bicycle. You either go forward or you fall off. So capitalism is a system that just requires continuous growth, and it's the best possible system. So economic growth is necessary because it sustains that system. Another argument about why we need economic growth, just it makes us better off. Humans are insatiable. It's human nature to always want more. And if we always want more, we need to have economic growth to provide more. Third, a lot of people are concerned about, well, global population, it's growing so fast. What are we going to do about population growth? And, you find these studies that show as countries become economically more developed, they have more income, their population growth goes down. And you find in families that are wealthier, the more money you make, the fewer children you have. So if we have this horrible problem of population, how do we solve it? More economic growth. And a lot of people are also worried about environmental issues. And I gave a talk in front of the Department of Environment and Conservation in Vermont, and I presented my views, and then an economist comes up and says, we can't afford to address our economic problems until our economy is bigger. We need more wealth, more income before we can do it. As George Bush said, if we hope to solve our environmental problems, we need more economic growth. The Kuznets curve is this study done back in the 1950s that shows in very poor countries, there's a very equal distribution of wealth. As you get to middle-income countries, you get an unequal distribution of wealth. And as you get rich again, you get an equal distribution of wealth. That's the Kuznets curve. The environmental Kuznets curve shows that in very poor countries, there is very little ecological degradation. In middle-income countries, there's a lot of ecological degradation. But as you get wealthy again, you environment is a luxury good. Rich people care about the environment. So as we get wealthy again, we start protecting the environment. That sulfur dioxide emissions are very low in poor countries. They're high in middle-income countries. But as you get wealthy again, they get lower again. Other big issue is poverty. So this is why you have progressives and liberals and the rich all favoring economic growth, because we've got to grow our way out of poverty. How can we say that the economy should not grow anymore when we have people who are barely making ends meet? And it's politically too difficult to redistribute resources. So what we've got to do is grow our way out of poverty. And we have to do that within our nation. We have to have more economic growth so that the poor people come better off. And it's our duty to have more economic growth because we trade with other nations, and our economy is the engine of growth for the world. And the growth of our economy is going to drag up those other economies with it. So if we stop growing, then these other poor countries are not going to have a chance to trade with us, and they're not going to have a chance to grow themselves. So it's a real serious issue. We have a moral obligation to continue our economic growth. And it's going to solve all these problems we face. So this is the common view. So I've talked about the why conventional economists, why almost everybody says we need economic growth. Now I want to look at the physics and ecology of continuous economic growth and ask if it's actually possible. So to begin with is the first law of thermodynamics. The laws of thermodynamics are considered by physicists as the supreme laws of nature. These are the laws that it's very interesting that economists always talk about laws that are really highly questionable hypotheses or assumptions. Physicists talk about laws, but this is the one law that really they don't mess with. This holds true. The basic idea, the basic law, first law of thermodynamics, is matter energy can't be created or destroyed. We can't make something from nothing. This means that all economic production is simply the material transformation of things that already exist. It requires raw materials provided by nature. It's the only source of something we have to make something from. So we have those material resources. Another thing I'll get back to in a second is you can't make nothing from something, which is also very relevant. But what this means is that the continuous physical growth of an economy on a finite planet is impossible. All economic production is the transformation of raw materials provided by nature. There's a finite supply of raw materials. There's only so large that the economy can become. It is sustained by and contained by the finite ecosystem. The second law of thermodynamics, what it is technically is entropy never decreases in an isolated system. Entropy you can think of as is basically disorder. So materials that are less useful from an economic perspective, it never decreases. So when our economy transforms raw materials provided by nature into economic use, those things wear out. Things wear out, fall apart, go towards greater disorder over time. They don't become nothing. They return to the ecosystem as waste. This is totally left out of conventional economic analysis. It's an irreversible qualitative change. It's referred to by physicists as time's arrow. This is a unidirectional change. We have only a finite stock of accumulated low entropy. The accumulated low entropy most important to our economy, arguably, is two things. One is the fossil fuels. It's accumulated low entropy that we have that we can use. And the other is the raw materials, the biological functions. So life has a way of, it doesn't create low entropy, but it captures solar energy and uses it to create order and usefulness. So our biological renewable resources are a renewable source of low entropy, but can't be renewed any faster than the sun provides them with energy to renew themselves. This other law of physics, it's impossible to do work without low entropy energy. There's no economic production without energy. This is very important, and this also, as I'll show a little bit later, is completely ignored by conventional economists to an embarrassing degree. So the ultimate limit to the physical size of the economic system is the low entropy provided by solar energy. Our fossil fuels are non-renewable. We can use those, but when those are gone, if we want to sustain a size of the economy, it requires solar energy. Things wear out, fall apart. We need a steady flow of solar energy just to maintain a given size of the economy. I'm saying that our society, our civilization, our populations require low entropy energy. And here's a relationship between economic growth and fossil fuel use. This is oil production. So it's a very tight link between GNP and oil fossil fuel use. Electricity, it's even a tighter link. Here's your electricity, here's your economic growth, very, very close. So economists argue that the driver of economic growth, the reason we've had this amazing explosion in growth and production and consumption, it's the magic of the market. This all started back in about 1776. This is Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith, first describing the origins of the market economy. Interestingly, the first effective steam engine was 1784. I don't know if you know the first major use of the steam engine. It was to pump water out of coal mines so that fossil fuels became a viable energy source. So the market economy and the fossil fuel economy began at virtually the same time. If you thought about how much work, how much effort you would have to expend to produce the energy or to as much usable energy as a barrel of oil, about 25,000 hours of work. So if you think about how, if you had to push your car to work every day instead of using gasoline, you realize how much energy we depend on. And that is, so now we're in the fossil fuel age. The question is it the magic of the market or is it the magic of fossil fuels that has driven all our economic growth and consumption? They say that our oil consumption, we use enough oil every day that increases our work capacity by 340 hours a day. So we can do, so it's like we have energy slaves. It's like we have, 50 different energy slaves working for us. And this is a finite resource. So that in the 1990s and up to today, we're producing far more oil than we're discovering. So new discoveries are very, very small. So I would actually argue, though, that that's fairly irrelevant, that it's not the source of energy that's the problem. It's the sink. It's the ability of the atmosphere to absorb our CO2 emissions, and that global climate change is more serious than fossil fuel depletion. But either way, if we have to slow global climate change, it means using less carbon-based energy, which is the dominant form of energy in our economy, which means that we cannot continue to sustain economic growth. Ecosystem services are fundamentally different from ecosystem goods. Ecosystem services are those benefits that ecosystems provide, life support functions for the planet. They often break them down into regulation services, which is the ability of the ecosystems to regulate our climate, to regulate atmospheric gases, to regulate water supply. They talk about provisioning services, which is their ability, ecosystems generate these, they allow the elements of ecosystem structure to reproduce. So, for example, in the Amazon, they, when the rain falls on the Amazon forest, it hits the canopy, breaks up into little mist, goes into the ground, is absorbed, recirculates through the trees, forms clouds, and falls again. You cut down the forest, the rain hits the ground, compacts it, carries away the soil, goes into the river, and is flushed out of the system forever. If you lose enough ecosystem structure, the forest loses the capacity to reproduce itself. So an ecosystem service is the ability of these ecosystems to renew themselves. They also talk about information services, genetic information, and they talk about provisioning, regulation. But anyway, there's a lot of these benefits that these structures provide. These are essential to human survival. Water purification, gas regulation. They're provided at a given rate over time. We can determine how fast we want to use the wood in a forest, but when you have a forest, it's capable of regulating a certain amount of rain per day. It's capable of creating a certain amount of oxygen, per unit of time. It's the benefits they provide are at a given rate over time. Other thing about these, if I use it, you can still use it. So I live in Burlington, Vermont, 1920s. They'd chopped down all the trees in the watershed when you had big rainfall events. Instead of being absorbed by nicely aerated soils with tree roots, they, you know, slammed into the compacted soil, went into the river, and caused major flood events. So now we have forests, and that doesn't happen. So my house is, actually my house is kind of far from the river, but a house along the river, it benefits from those forests. You know, real benefit, keeps from being wiped out and flooded, but the fact that that house owner benefits doesn't leave any less flood protection for the next guy downstream. The fact that I benefit from a stable climate, or our country benefits by having healthy agriculture, doesn't leave any less stable climate for other people. The fact that we benefit from the ozone layer to keep us from getting skin cancer doesn't leave any less ozone layer for other people. So these resources, my use doesn't leave less for anybody else, so we can cooperate in their use. Whereas the structure we compete for, one person uses it, the other can't, the services we can all use together, and therefore it makes sense to all provide together. Other thing is, you can't own this. You know, a guy upstream can't say, hey, you know, I've got a nice forested watershed. You're benefiting from this. If you don't pay me, I'm going to just, you know, stop providing water regulation for you. You'll be flooded. It doesn't work like that. You can't single this out. You can't say, oh, you know, if you don't pay for the ozone layer is mine. I'm not going to let you use it unless you pay me. You know, it doesn't work like that. Climate stability doesn't work like that. They can't be owned. They don't fit in. And if you can't own something, you can't sell it. And if you can't sell it, it doesn't fit into the market model. So these are non-market goods. There's no price signal to indicate scarcity. What economists love about markets is when something becomes scarce, the price goes up, we develop a substitute. Or we provide more of it somehow. That doesn't happen with these ecosystem services. And I would argue these ecosystem services, they're essential to human survival, vital life support functions, and they are becoming very scarce. And there's no price signal to indicate that scarcity. So the laws of ecology, those are some of the laws of physics. The laws of ecology, raw materials converted into economic products are elements of ecosystem structure. Ecosystem services are provided by a special configuration of ecosystem structure. So you can have a nice, healthy forest, provides water regulation, you know, air filtration, habitat for biodiversity, all these other things. When you chop down the trees, you could leave them there. You still have the same elements of structure, but it's a different configuration. It no longer provides those services. So without the goods, without the intact ecosystem, you lose your services. When we take those structural components away, there is an opportunity cost. We lose life support functions, vital services. And the thing is, we are very, very ignorant of how structure provides services, how structure provides functions. We don't know these things. What we actually find very often is we don't know the value of an ecosystem service until we've destroyed it. Once we've destroyed it, we say, hey, that had a real use, really good use. An example is, you know, we've wiped out sardines around the planet. You know, their populations have plunged. And what they've recently discovered is sardines eat a lot of phytoplankton. And when they eat that phytoplankton, they excrete it, and it goes to the bottom of the ocean, is sequestered, and it's a way of sequestering carbon dioxide. When they don't eat it, it ferments on the surface, creates methane, 23 times more powerful than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, and goes into the atmosphere and causes global warming. So who would have thought that sardines play a role in regulating our global climate? We know that now, but we didn't know it 3 years ago. And there's all sorts of these things that we keep discovering how elements of ecosystem structure provide these vital ecosystem services. The basic idea is every time we extract raw materials, we deplete ecosystem services. Every time we spew waste into the environment in the form of our, you know, usually from using our non-renewable resources, we dispose of these wastes, that depletes ecosystem services. Both goods and services are essential. And economic growth has this opportunity cost of wiping out those ecosystem services. We need those to survive, and it's an opportunity cost. Economists always talk about opportunity cost, but they neglect the most important one. We are now using more, we are consuming more than ecosystems can sustainably provide, starting around 1980, or a little, so what we're doing is we're depleting our capital. We're using up the capital instead of living off the interest is what we need to do. We have to live off income, not capital. We're living off of capital, not income right now. It's a completely inappropriate economic system now. So there's this idea of weak versus strong sustainability. Weak sustainability says that increased human-made capital is a substitute for depleted natural capital. As we wipe out all of our natural capital, convert our forests into houses, and convert our our minerals into and our ores into infrastructure and buildings, if the value of what we produce is greater than the value of what we lose, we're doing great. And you can measure everything in dollars. So we measure human capital, natural capital, human-made or natural capital in dollars. $1 is as good as another. We don't care. And that's what led 2 years ago now, Schelling, the Nobel laureate, to say that doesn't matter. Global warming doesn't matter because if we lose global agriculture, it's only 3% of GNP. No harm done. And he said, you can look it up on the internet. He said, he didn't say we could lose it. He said, we have 1/3 decrease in agricultural production, no problem. So, Robert Schelling, the Nobel laureate from 2005, I think. So, what these weak sustainability theorists say is that if a resource becomes scarce, there's a price increase and we innovate, and the ultimate resource is the human mind, no problem it can't solve. So we don't have to worry. We have to worry about relative scarcity. Something becomes scarcer than something else, but not absolute scarcity. What this neglects, of course, is that ecosystem services don't have that price signal. So we don't substitute for those. Strong sustainability, on the other hand, says the two are not substitutes. Natural capital, the raw materials, and the ecosystem services are required for survival. That built capital, human-made things, are complements to natural capital, not substitutes. A standard production function in every economics textbook is capital and labor. There are no natural resource inputs. There are no waste outputs. Sometimes, the more open-minded economists will put in natural capital. The raw materials is an essential input. But they are shown as perfect substitutes. So if we don't have enough of the raw, of the natural capital, we have more capital and more labor to substitute. So, you think about it, if the economists wrote recipe books, they could say, you need this many ingredients to serve 8 people, but if you don't have enough ingredients, get a bigger oven or have somebody else help you with the cooking and you'll be fine. You can substitute capital and labor for raw ingredients. And this is what every economics textbook shows. If they go to the effort of including natural resources, they show them as substitutes. And so I think it's fortunate that they don't write our cookbooks. The point is labor and capital are useless without raw materials. Both things are needed. In other words, the strong sustainability people are right. We can't wipe out the capacity of ecosystems to reproduce the raw materials we need. And we also depend entirely on the life support functions. So we live in a world right now, exponential growth. How does exponential growth relate to this? We're not saying, let's add $100 million to our GNP every year. They're saying we need 3% growth. And we're not satisfied with increasing our ability to consume by a fixed amount every year. It's got to be a percentage increase. And exponential growth, I don't know if people have heard this parable of the 29th day, that if you have lilies on a pond that double in volume every day, and your pond is half covered in lilies on the 29th day, when is your pond fully covered in lilies? And that's the 30th day. And so the point is, we can look at our resources and say, we've only used up half. But in exponential growth, that means one more doubling time and they are all gone. A doubling time is, so if we have a growth rate of our economy of 3% per year, which is what we're striving for, 4% per year, we're talking about that annual growth rate translates into a doubling time of, say, 24 to 28 years. So if we've used up half our resources, that means we have about 28 years before we use up all of them. And it's what we're striving for is, they were very pessimistic that our economy is only growing now at 2.2% per year, which is like a 30-something year doubling time. So the economic problem from the ecological economist point of view is, the neoclassical economists say, how do we take those raw materials provided by nature and create the greatest monetary value? Ecological economists take a step back, say, how do we allocate ecosystem structure, which is finite, between economic production, which we absolutely need, and between the planetary life support functions essential to our survival? The argument is that a couple hundred years ago, these were scarce. This is what we had to focus on. Now this is scarce. This is what we have to focus on. And because these things are unpriced, it seems we have the wrong economic system to achieve that. You know, these life support functions have no price. So market decisions are, you know, the question is, can we, some people have tried to say, well, let's put a price on these. And they put a price on them by estimating how much people would be willing to pay for them. And then you would feed that information back into the economy. And somebody recently did a study on the value of the Amazon rainforest. So they figured they'd survey the people in the Amazon rainforest to see how much they would be willing to pay to preserve the forest. Indigenous tribes. How much would these indigenous tribes be willing to pay? Well, the indigenous tribes don't use money, but they do trade salt. So they calculated the value of the Amazon rainforest in terms of salt and then took the monetary value of salt, which is fairly low. So they found out that the Amazon's worth $20 per hectare per year. So this is, market decisions are based on $1, one vote. Those with no money have no votes. And that's, you know, 80% of the world's population has very little vote. And we have 30% of the world's vote with 4% of the population. Maybe not the best way to make the decisions. We have an option, fortunately. We have an option of democratic decisions. And I'm going to get back to that and say how we could use democratic decisions to make to solve some of these problems. So the other question is, continuous economic growth desirable? I'm arguing it's impossible. Is it desirable? So what we've said for a long time is that, and economists say, the economic growth makes us better off, that we consume much more, you know, therefore, and one way of measuring being better off might be happy. So a guy mentioned the smile factor. He says, you know, Americans consume 30% of the world's resources. There's an argument for saying that's okay if we are the happiest people on the planet. If you walked around the United States and everybody was just glowing smiles and really happy, then there would be a justification for doing that. If we're not happier than other people, there seems to be very little justification. And so not only are we not the happiest people on the planet, there are studies that look at the trends in happiness and satisfaction with life in the United States, and they find, if anything, they're edging down. And same with Western Europe, that more and more consumption is not making us measurably better off. But this is from the World Value Study, which is a global study asking a lot of different questions. One question they ask is, how happy are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Another is, how satisfied are you with the life as a whole? And when they average those two things, you put that on this axis, and here you have GNP and purchasing power parity, which means that how much could you consume if you were in the United States? So $5,000 purchasing power parity is how well you would live with $5,000 in the United States, basically, putting all countries on the same scale. And what you see is very dramatic increases in life satisfaction and well-being, up to about $5,000 per person per year in the U.S. And after that, it just kind of flattens out. And the U.S. is the richest country. We're definitely not the happiest. We're about on par with Colombia, which is just over that $5,000 a year. So there's very little evidence using this subjective measure that ever-increasing economic growth makes us better off. There's another index, the Human Development Index. This is just a weighted, this includes, along with GNP, it actually includes life expectancy, literacy rates, and number of people in school. And this shows the levels of human development around the planet. And if you track human development against GNP, you find almost an identical trend. Dramatic improvements in education and health up to about $5,000 per year, and then it flattens out. So that's an objective measure of GNP's relationship to our well-being. Subjectively or objectively, you don't see a strong relationship. Another assessment is the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, which is a way of adjusting our GNP for hours worked, you know, leisure time, expenditures on, you know, depleting. You know, like right now, when we had Exxon Valdez, that boosted our GDP. The Katrina boosted our GDP because we had to spend a lot of money dealing with a problem. So this subtracts those negative expenses. And what you find is around the world, for a long time, the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare and GNP tracked. But then our Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare, a better measure of our welfare than GNP by almost any standard, starts to go down. And it, you know, in the U.S. it starts to go down around 1970. And in other countries in the, you know, U.K. later 70s. Chile is like, you know, here's GNP skyrocketing. GDP was going down at the same, or ISCW is going down. They don't track very well. And in a lot of these countries, they start to go down just about the time that the ecological footprint you know, we surpass the carrying capacity of the planet. So the question is, if GNP is not the desirable end, what is? What is it that would increase our quality of life, et cetera? So you know, the basic point is until we know what the desirable ends are, we can't possibly figure out how to allocate resources towards them. You need to have a destination before you know how to get there. And if you don't know where you're going, you will wind up somewhere else. And that's a Yogi Berra quote. And I would say until we decide what it is we want for a society, we don't know where we're going. Right now, we say what we want is ever-increasing economic consumption. And I would, another Yogi Berra quote is, we might be lost, but we're making great time. And as a friend of mine, another quote that I thought was very appropriate was a shoveling fuel for a runaway train. You know, and that is what, when we're pursuing economic growth, it's impossible, no indication it's desirable, we're pursuing the wrong goal, we're lost, and we've got to decide what the right goal is. So look at some of the literature. It's a booming field, the economics of happiness. What is it that makes people happy? Money, they've looked at that, and it's not very. And, you know, I showed those relationships between GNP. It turns out that actually people who have more money are a little bit happier than people who have less, but it depends on your neighbors. If you make $180,000 a year and you live in a neighborhood where people make $250,000 a year, you feel poor. If you make $25,000 a year and you live in a neighborhood where people make $18,000 a year, you feel rich and you're happy. So there's a so it's relative wealth that matters, not absolute wealth. And it's really interesting. You can ask people, virtually any income class, how much more money would it take you to be happy? That's always about 10%. You always got to earn about 10% more than you currently make. And it's because we're striving for the wrong thing. What they do find makes people happy is desiring less. You just decide you don't need these things, and then you are more happy. Having friends, big component, those social relationships, community, that makes people very happy. Marriage tends to make people happy. Not all marriages, obviously, but religion, community, having a community, and religion does tend to make people happy, but community, I think it's the community aspect of it. Helping others, big correlation. Those who spend more time helping others tend to be happier people. Older people tend to be happier than younger people. This is like, you know, averaged out. This is the statistics. So what makes people unhappy is the other thing we got to look at. Well, pursuit of material gain, one of the strongest signs that somebody will be unhappy is they say, I want to be rich. And they actually find, so, you know, there's a quote, young adults who focus on money, image, and fame tend to be more depressed, have less enthusiasm for life, and suffer more physical symptoms, such as headaches and sore throats than others. So not only does it manifest itself in unhappiness, but in physical symptoms. Those who really, really want to be rich, who want to be, motivated to get more money, they're not very happy. Another big thing is comparing yourself with others. If you compare yourself with others, it makes you very unhappy. So why do we consume? We spend $700 billion a year globally on telling people you got to consume to be happy. We're insatiable because we're trying to satisfy our needs using the wrong things. The answer is always to consume more. And so I would argue that advertising, I would say that quality of life is our ability to satisfy our needs and wants. Advertising creates more needs and more wants, I should say, without any increase in ability to satisfy. So it's a public bad. It undermines our public welfare. We have given their airways are public property. They weren't created by any corporations. We own those. We gave those away. We gave those away to people to make us feel bad. Probably not a wise thing to do. So I would argue quality of life is the fulfillment of human needs, and there's really neat research on this. And what they find is that, you know, human needs are a lot more than just consumption, and I'll show a list of what they are. Market goods are one of many human needs, and for real human needs, satiation occurs. The needs tend to be constant across cultures, but how we satisfy them differs. So the question now is, would ending economic growth be a sacrifice? So what would happen if, I'm not talking about growth here, I'm talking about something way more radical than any politician has ever suggested that you have heard. I mean, even Dennis Kucinich doesn't go this far. But what would happen if our GNP declined by 2/3 in the U.S.? How miserable would that make us? You know, in what year did we have a per capita consumption 2/3 of what, or 1/3 of what we have today? Any ideas? So it is, 1969. So, you know, in 1969, people consumed 1/3 of what they consume today. And, you know, the point is, how miserable were we then? The interesting thing, too, is that the energy intensity of GDP in 1969 was 2 times what it is today, meaning we could achieve That level of consumption we had in 1969, using 17% of the energy we currently use, which would actually be enough, an 83% reduction would be enough to stabilize a global atmospheric CO2. And so we could protect our ecosystems, the vital life support functions, not have this problem with global warming. The thing is, so looking at the genuine progress indicator is very similar to the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare I talked about earlier. And what it shows is that this measure, a far superior measure of our actual well-being, peaked in 1969. And if you look at happiness levels, they were up there. They were about as good in 1969 as they are today. We have seen no improvements in a significant way since 1969, and yet we have made massive sacrifices. If you look at global climate stability, if you look at ozone depletion, if you look at all these things, my point here is there's no sacrifice to go back to 1969. And the other thing to point out is poverty levels in 1969 were lower than they are today. So, on all these things. So the other thing that people say, we need economic growth to alleviate poverty. We have tripled the size of our economy, and we have increased our poverty levels. And if you look at it globally, if we want to end global poverty, globally, I mean, because of China, you take China out of it and the whole picture changes. But with China in there, there is a correlation between economic growth and decreasing poverty. But if we want to get everybody out of poverty through economic growth, we would have to increase the size of our economy about 20 more times. So the global economy would have to increase 20-fold to get rid of poverty if countries did what China does. A lot of countries have seen their poverty go up under economic growth. So the question is, can the market guide us in this macro allocation problem, deciding how big the economy should be, how much ecosystem structure we devote to economic output, how much we leave intact for providing ecosystem services? Can the economy guide us? Economists say, yes, it's the best thing. We've just got to create markets everywhere. Got to have markets everywhere. So feedback mechanisms, what we got to do is, right now, markets don't signal resource scarcity, but we can make them do it. They don't signal resource scarcity of ecosystem services, but we can make them do it. So, and then we'll have that feedback if people have to pay when biodiversity goes down, biodiversity becomes scarce, they have to pay more, then they'd reduce use, or they'd innovate, or they'd increase the supply of biodiversity somehow. So we get that feedback mechanism. So the question is, we have a finite supply of marketable natural resources. Economists say they become scarce, price goes up, and we increase supply. So take a look at our oceanic fish. As the price goes up, do they suddenly start to reproduce more? The fact is that oceanic fish, 70% are fished at or beyond capacity. Bluefin tuna is one of the ones that's very quickly in danger of going extinct. You know, a bluefin tuna, as they become scarce, their price goes up. The price of the record sale for a bluefin tuna, I have it in the textbook, I forget what it is, I think it was $210,000 for one fish. $50,000 to $100,000 is fairly typical for one bluefin tuna. The fact is, when they become scarce, the price goes up, so we fish them faster. It's the feedback loop goes in the wrong direction. You know, does oil become more abundant as the price goes up? You know, we have a finite supply of oil. It is not affected by the price increase. Economists tell you, though, it does. But there's no market signal whatsoever for public goods, for these things like the ozone layer. And we could figure out ways to create them, but I'm not real impressed with the service of these. So I would say the scarcest goods are ecosystem services. Scarcity does not lead to a price increase and does not lead to innovation. So the market mechanism fails as the scarce resources increasingly become these non-market goods, and that's what's happening. So what do we do then? What can we do? And here's where, basically to answer this question, you know, you need another 40 lectures like this to answer it in any plausible way. But and you can answer it quite well. We do have great solutions, and there are very clear things we can do. But what can we do quickly? I would say the policy sequence we really have to keep track of, how we make decisions. Economists say, like the Stern Review says, the first thing is pricing. The first thing is efficiency. We got to make sure markets are all about efficiency. We allocate efficiently using prices. Ecological economists say no. The first thing is figuring out what is the ecologically sustainable scale. Scale I defined earlier is the size of the economic system relative to the sustaining and containing ecosystem. So the first thing is we have to figure that out. It means we can't deplete renewable resources faster than they renew themselves. If we do that, we're really gonna lose them. We can't spew waste into the atmosphere or into the waters faster than it can be absorbed, or we're going to have catastrophic results. And we can't deplete essential non-renewables faster than we develop renewable substitutes. Right now, we depend for our survival on oil. They say that to generate a calorie of food, a calorie of carbohydrate, takes 10 calories of hydrocarbons. So they say that 95% of the nitrogen in your body was fixed by the Haber process, I guess it is, using natural gas. So we are totally dependent on fossil fuels, and we are depleting them much faster than we're developing substitutes. We're developing new uses way faster than we're developing substitutes. People say, ah, ethanol, that's a substitute. One BTU of ethanol takes 9/10 of a BTU of fossil fuels. That's the optimists. The pessimists say we're actually spending 1.2 units of energy of fossil fuel to create one unit of energy of ethanol. Subsidized, of course, massively subsidized by the government. So this is the first thing we got to decide on. Second thing is, if we're going to limit resource use, we've got to decide who gets it, who's entitled to those things. If we limit, so an example of how markets do that, they wanted to charge fair prices for, they decided to create markets in water in South Africa. So they were going to charge people for use of water, the marginal cost of using water. And in South Africa, poor people couldn't afford it. So they went and drank out of rivers that rich people were flushing drinking water into, along with their feces, unfortunately. So basically, we were allocating water to rich people to use to flush their waste. And poor people couldn't afford drinking water, had to drink that wastewater, got cholera. So you had cholera epidemics that caused massive, big epidemics that cost a huge amount of money. So the point is, we got to decide who is entitled to, if we allow the market to decide who gets to use water, you get perverse outcomes. And we got to figure out another way to do that. And then finally, once we've decided on these things, we look at economically efficient allocation, which is what the economists say goes first. But how we allocate depends on the desirable ends and the scarce resources. So what is it we want? And I'm going to give some examples of where markets are horrendously inefficient. But this has to take third place to scale and distribution. So, and I could go on a long length explaining, actually using neoclassical economic arguments, why that's true as well. For one thing, economists say that an efficient allocation, markets are wonderful because they lead to an efficient allocation. An efficient allocation is possible for every different distribution, but will be different. So in the United States, we efficiently produce lots of slums and lots of yachts. In Scandinavia, they efficiently produce very few slums and very few yachts, and that depends on the initial distribution. So the desirability of your efficient allocation can be no greater than the desirability of the just distribution, or the distribution that leads to it. And that's I could go into that with neoclassical economics, but question is, though, how do you determine optimal scale? How do we decide how much of things to use? Obviously, it's got to be a process informed by science, but the market can't solve that problem. We know that. We need democratic solutions informed by science. Society as a whole has to decide tolerable rates of throughput. And we don't want to be at the limits of sustainability. We want to be well within those limits. So we got to figure out how society can decide that. And I'll get to one solution out of many possible ones in a minute. How do we determine just distribution? Again, I would argue we could say, well, individuals are entitled to what they earn with the sweat of their brow. If I work hard to produce something, nobody better take that away from me. And that's, that's a very conservative value, but also a shared value. But values provided by nature belong to us all. Why is Exxon entitled to the oil on the ground? Why do they get $46 billion in windfall profits? Shouldn't that oil belong to Americans? Did Exxon produce it, or was that provided by nature? Why should they get the right to it? They should get a fair return on their labor, fair return on their capital and their entrepreneurial abilities, but that $46 billion was above and beyond that. So individuals should compensate society for degrading these resources. If you pollute, you got to compensate for the damage you do to society, and values provided by society as a whole belong to us. But most of these aren't degraded by use. Cultural assets and information, anybody can use those, and they're still available. So if you look at, Walt Disney has put patents on, how many popular tales from our cultural history has Walt Disney patented? So, Cinderella, Hercules, Snow White, all these things, they're patented. You can't use those things without Walt Disney's permission. How many stories has Walt Disney added to the public domain? They have taken from the public domain charges for those things. They have added nothing to the public domain. Anything they've produced, you got to pay for. Pretty much a so these, I would argue, those things they've taken from society as a whole belong to us, but you can use them without degrading them. Walt Disney can use them, but then they just can't prevent us from using them afterwards, which is what they do. So markets fail at determining just distribution. So I would argue, again, it's got to be a democratic process. And one, there's many, many approaches to this and many good ideas and many policies. I'm going to present one partly because it's currently being looked at by the legislature in Vermont. And this might become Vermont law, hoping very fervently it will. That right now there are no current property rights to waste absorption capacity. Nobody owns that. Nobody has the right to spew their waste into the atmosphere. We can create property rights. And we've continually created property rights. It's a constant process within our economic history. You know, hunter-gatherers know property rights to land. Agriculturalists needed those property rights. We created them. And it didn't used to matter that there were property rights to waste absorption capacity because it was super abundant. Now it's scarce. Now we have to create property rights. So we can create those property rights to waste absorption capacity, and we assign those to society as a whole. We create a trust fund, a board of trustees, a commons trust that protects waste absorption capacity and air quality for this and water quality for this and future generations. They have a legal mandate not to exceed that. If they don't act according to the guidelines of that legal mandate, then we can sue them. And what they can do is decide, okay, well, we have this waste absorption capacity for carbon dioxide. You know, if you don't spew carbon dioxide into the atmosphere more than the ecosystem can absorb, it does no harm whatsoever. Other things do harm, but we could reduce those levels to a level where the harms are acceptable, because you can't produce something without using energy and without using natural resources. Waste is inevitable. But we could auction off and sell the permits to pollute. They would go to the public trust. Anybody who is damaging the commons has to compensate the commons. Very fair. It's hard to argue that's not fair. And it doesn't interfere with any existing property rights. The revenue then belongs to the community. So what do you do with that revenue? Well, one thing, I would argue that information, they say we live in the information age. Unquestionably, information is required to solve the problems we face right now. And information right now, we mostly is provided by the private sector, which means separate teams of researchers not allowed to talk to each other, not allowed to share ideas, which is an extremely inefficient way to provide information. Once they've developed something, they patent it, which a patent is a monopoly. They're the only ones allowed to produce it. Very, very inefficient. Then they can sell it for monopoly profits, but information gets better through use. It doesn't wear out through use. So we're rationing use to those who can afford it, even though if more people used it, we'd be better off. And I can show very clearly neoclassical economic arguments that that's extremely inefficient, creates what they call a deadweight loss of economic surplus. And a recent example is, Indonesia has refused to give the avian flu virus to the World Health Organization, because if they give it to the World Health Organization, the World Health Organization will give it to corporations that will develop patented vaccines that Indonesia can't afford. So Indonesia is selling it to the corporations. And the corporations then have to, the part of the deal is they'll have to give any vaccines they find to Indonesia, but of course the rest of the world won't be able to afford those vaccines. And if they can't afford those vaccines, then we're almost guaranteed a pandemic of avian flu. We would all be better off if people took that medicine and were using the market to deprive them of the ability to take that medicine. And the costs of producing the medicine are very small, but the patent royalties are very high, monopoly profits. So what we could do, though, is there is this problem that a lot of, I talked about ecosystem services are provided by ecosystem structure, but large elements of ecosystem structure are privately owned. So we have these, Vermont's 80% forest. You have these forest landowners. They own that forest. They bought it with the idea they could cut down that forest and use the timber, et cetera. And if we take away that right from them, that doesn't necessarily seem fair. But what we could do is use the money we get to pay them to simply provide those ecosystem services. They do this in Costa Rica right now. Costa Rica's had a dramatic increase in reforestation because they pay people for the benefits provided to society for reforesting their land. So they reversed their enormous decline. I mean, they had one of the fastest rates of deforestation in the world. They reversed that and have turned it around by paying people to provide public benefits. And what's left over, you can distribute equally to everybody. So that if you're charging people to spew waste, like right now, if we have a gas tax, well, poor people spend a lot more of their income on gasoline than rich people, so it's very regressive. But if we have this kind of system, and you distribute some of the benefits equally to everybody, those who use less than average gain, those who use more than average lose. It redistributes income in a very fair way based on fair principles. So the question is this feasible? And I would argue the economic systems, there's, in spite of this book, The End of History and the Last Man, that says that we've reached the end, you know, there's no more evolution in economic system, economic systems continually evolve. We started out with this hunter-gatherer economy. It had limited wants, unlimited means. You know, that anything you wanted, anything you needed, you'd made from local things. And actually, hunter-gatherers didn't work very hard, and they were pretty well nourished for the most part. They worked about 3 to 4 hours a day. But when we developed agriculture, we suddenly needed to create property rights. We had population density. We had a free flow of ideas. Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he attributes the dramatic increase in technology to the free flow of ideas. There's a really cool history of Genghis Khan that's out right now. He conquered most of the world, and he shared everywhere he went. He took the ideas and introduced them to the next culture and the next culture and the Mongolian culture, and he established free trade routes that allowed trade and ideas to circulate. And this book argues that the Renaissance was a direct result of Genghis Khan conquering the world and allowing the free flow of ideas. And so the agricultural economies allowed that population density, allowed us to have, you know, we needed political systems, all these other things. Industrial economies, the non-renewable resources and their waste stream, and that created a whole new economic system. And now we need to develop an ecological economy. And these changes continually occur. And when you were in a feudal system saying we need a free market economy, people said you're crazy, that can never happen. You know, I mean, these changes, we say that we can't change, but the fact is we are changing, it's inevitable. We can direct that change in the right direction. So what would an ecological economy look like? You know, I'd say we focus on desired ends and the scarce resources before we decide on allocation mechanisms. We don't use markets to allocate information. We don't use markets to allocate ecosystem services. We do use markets potentially to allocate a lot of different, like especially luxury goods. Got to think twice about using markets to allocate essential non-substitutable resources like food and water. But we can use some market mechanisms, but and markets totally fail at ecosystem services. They fail at allocating information. This economic problem of allocating ecosystem structure between economic output and ecosystem services, it's got to be decided on democratic principles, I would argue, not plutocratic principles. I think that commons trust is a democratic principle. And all you need there, what you're really doing is you're creating a third sector of the commons trust. It's not public, it's not private, it's the commons sector. And the government, theoretically, should be providing our ecosystem services, providing our common good benefits, but we see that government is too corruptible. So we have, but occasionally, we get good governments. Occasionally, we get people who do the right things. All you need is a brief window of opportunity for one of these governments to say, we're going to create this commons trust, legally mandate a property rights awarded to that commons trust. Then you have a third sector with legally binding obligations, and you need one window of opportunity to create that sector, and then you've got the problem solved for indefinite time. You're giving property rights to future generations. You're addressing the sustainability issue. And I'd been thinking about these ideas for a really long time, but then Peter Barnes came up with Working Assets. He crystallized those ideas in a way I thought was absolutely brilliant. So this commons trust, I really think, is an approach. I think to get any of these things, though, right now, everybody buys into this idea that the only way we're going to be happy is through ever-increasing economic consumption. We've got to create an alternative vision of a desirable and sustainable future. We've got to have a positive message. If we go in this direction, we're better off, we're happier. Instead of the negative message of misery, gloom, doom, of that we too often hear. And that positive, it's in my mind, it's got to be a democratically decided vision. We've got to have a shared participation, all sectors of society participating, versus our current status quo, where we go is determined by who has the money. We need common ground. We did this process once where we brought a lot of people together from different backgrounds, different ideas, to the different sectors of the society to look at what America should look like in 2100. And we found that it had very little to do with economic production. In fact, the vision had probably a much smaller economy, a much, much smaller economy than we have today, much more, you know, time to engage civically, much more time with community and friends, and that civic engagement so that we actually learn to be citizens, not consumers, learn how to elect good people, learn how to be representatives of our own government. And that, you know, that it was very interesting. And I find you look for common ground. I have some extreme right-wing fundamentalist Christian relatives, and when we talk about what our vision is for a good society, there's a huge amount we share, huge amount. In fact, I would say what we share overwhelms what we disagree on. And you really need these shared visions that everybody engages in them, and it's a continuous process. You don't develop a vision. This is a continuous engaging process, and we need to develop ways for doing that. And so basically right now, we have this status quo vision of ever-increasing economic growth. I would say it's not sustainable. It's not desirable. I'd say we're currently sacrificing our quality of life in order to consume more. I think we're going to be forced into alternative paths. So those who promote the status quo vision is desirable, they are going to become the prophets of doom and gloom. Those who are saying we need economic growth, but we can't do it anymore. Oh, no, what's going to happen? And I think we're getting to the point where we're going to find there are very serious limits to economic growth. And that's what global climate change is imposing that on us. Peak oil is imposing that on us. Depletion of the oceanic fisheries is imposing that on us. And those who stick to this vision of more and more growth as being the right one, they're going to be the folks who are pessimistic and offer nothing. And those of us who come up with an alternative vision and promote that alternative vision of a desirable future are, have the positive dream. And as they said in that end of environmentalism thing, that Martin Luther King wouldn't have gotten very far if he'd given an I have a nightmare speech. And so what we need is the I have a dream speech, and these folks are going to be the proponents of the I have a nightmare speech. Oh, my gosh, we can't do anymore what makes us happy. So I think that's basically the basic points. Enhancing our quality of life is inherently sustainable because the things that enhance our quality of life don't rely on consumption, community, friendship, all those things. And that sustainability is not a sacrifice. It's going to lead to a better world, and that's the message we need to be giving to people if we want to ever achieve that world.
Audio recordings of this and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speaker and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.